Wow, Rick Lombardo, fellow alum of Boston University's Master of Fine Arts Directing Program. You are proof that an MFA in directing works, right?
Well, I'm proof that if you stick to it long enough, eventually the world allows your level of incompetence to rise.
Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, whatever it is, wherever you are. Thanks for subscribing, streaming, or downloading and listening to us on your computer or MP3 player. I'm Austin Titchener, one third of the Reduced Shakespeare Company, and you're listening to this week's Reduced Shakespeare Company podcast, number 237, San Jose Repertory. Rick Lombardo is the artistic director of the San Jose Repertory Theater in the capital of the Silicon Valley, San Jose, California. But prior to that, he was the artistic director of New Repertory Theater in Boston, a freelance director in New York City and around the country, and a fellow MFA student with me at Boston University. We just spent a fantastic week at San Jose Rep performing The Complete World of Sports Abridged, and after the Wednesday matinee, Rick and I met in his office to catch up.
I just went to grad school right out of undergrad, so I was, when I graduated, I was 25 or 26.
You were a wunderkind. And where's the cutoff point? When does one cease being a wunderkind?
Well, according to me, I still am. According to my daughter, I'm ancient.
Yeah, so. Yes. Right. Oh, and she's a teenager now, right?
Yeah, 14.
Oh, God. And an ancient and an idiot.
And a moron.
And a moron.
And an embarrassing moron.
That is now our job as parents. But you're now the artistic director of San Jose Repertory Theater, where we're performing sports right now. But this is our second time here. Our last time we were here for Timothy Neer. Talk a little bit about what you did when you came out of BU. What does one do? If one is going into an MFA in directing program, what does one do then with that piece of paper?
Well, you know, I never thought that I would end up doing what I'm doing.
Really?
I didn't set out to be an artistic director. And if you had asked me when we were in graduate school, my plan was I'm going to have a Tony Award by the age of 30.
Okay.
That was the plan.
It's a great plan.
You know, I was from New York, and I just thought I'm going to go back to New York, and I'm just going to start directing, and I'll be on Broadway. Yeah. And
as one does.
Yeah. And the reality is that I actually did assist on several Broadway shows that really soured me on the experience of big budget commercial theater.
Interesting.
They were all projects that had great promise initially, and then all those things happen where people start blaming each other and the show goes the wrong direction, and there's so much money involved, nobody wants to feel like it's their fault. Mm-hmm. So in each instance, I saw people who really loved each other in the beginning and had the best creative instincts at play, eventually just trying to not be the one whose fault it was.
Right. So everybody's not only are they not on the same page, they're all sort of scattering and trying to assign blame.
You know, I can't say that's for everything, but on my young experience, you know, the three or four shows that I worked on, it happened pretty consistently.
Right.
And at the same time, I was teaching. So I was teaching, directing, and acting in New York. And so I eventually started a theater company. A small off-Broadway theater company.
Also, as one does in New York City.
On Theater Row.
Okay.
We were in the Nat Horn Theater, which I think is now gone.
Location,
but we were right on the corner where the Lincoln Tunnel comes out, on the opposite corner from Playwrights Horizons.
Okay.
And did that for a few years. And I was also freelancing around town, and I was doing all kinds of stuff, from working with insanely brilliant performance artists down on the Lower East Side, to running my own company, which was basically focused on new plays, American realism kind of stuff. We wanted to be Steppenwolf.
Right.
And then I was directing these, you know, big Broadway concerts, revivals of old musicals with Broadway stars.
Right.
Before the Encore series, it was the New Amsterdam Theater Company. We were at Town Hall.
Yeah.
So I was doing all these very different things.
Yeah.
And I eventually realized that I had no clue who all these audience people were. Like, they were so different. And I put together that I was the kind of director who didn't do shows for myself.
Oh.
That it really was about wanting to do shows for a particular audience. You know, knowing them, you know how to push their buttons, you know what their history has been, what their experiences have been, and then you plan plays to take them to another place. And just the light bulb went off one day, and I realized, you know, that's what an artistic director at a regional theater does. Mm. Guess what?
Mm.
And after 6 or 7 years doing all of this in New York, and being a New York kid, I would never have thought I would leave the city.
Right.
But in 92, I thought maybe I need to go try the regional theater route.
Okay.
And right away, I got this offer to go out to Ohio. To a theater that I'd never heard of before, that was sort of semi-professional. I wasn't very interested in going out to Ohio, but my ex-wife had grown up there, and she said, no, you should go check it out. And they offered me the chance to go out and direct Death of a Salesman. Found out pretty quickly that I still did miss the East Coast.
Okay.
But the most important thing is I met my current wife there. And then we started looking, and New Repertory Theater, which was in Boston, mm-hmm. they were doing a search for their founder. It just retired after 12 years. And so they were looking for somebody to succeed the founder, which is always dicey.
Yeah.
As I discovered.
Yeah, you don't want to be the rebound artistic director.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. Second artistic directors tend to not last very long.
Mm-hmm.
But you bucked that trend.
Well, I called a lot of friends, a lot of our friends who were still in Boston, and I said, okay, tell me about this theater, New Rep. And if I'm coming back to the East Coast to a small professional theater, it needs to be one that is positioned that could really become a significant and legitimate mid-sized player in Boston.
Right.
And all my friends said, if there's any theater in Boston that could step into that role, it's going to be New Rep.
Mm-hmm.
And is it actually in Boston? It's one of the boroughs.
Yeah, well, it was in Newton. So we were just outside of Boston.
Because, I mean, Boston famously has Huntington Theater, which is associated with Boston University, and American Repertory Theater at Harvard.
Right. And for years and years and years, like the years we were there, and then almost nothing else.
Yeah.
Then a couple of really tiny professional theaters.
Merrimack Rep in Lowell being one of them. My little American Stage Festival farther north in Milford, New Hampshire, which was only summer.
But within the metro Boston area.
Yes.
But New Rep had started, I guess, in 85 or 86 and had grown really fast and then it stopped and acquired a big debt. And the founder had retired and was really trying to figure out what the next steps were going to be. And we had lived in Boston, and I knew, it was a great city. So I thought, well, let's give this a try. And I thought maybe I'd be there 5 years, and then 13 years later, I turned around and I thought, wow, this has been a significant part of my life now.
Well, and you talk about you want to create theater for a specific audience. You knew the New England, or at least the Boston audience.
Yeah. And that was the great part, because the one thing that I did inherit was a pretty smart and loyal audience base. Yeah. You know, the Boston audience is, for the most part, really educated. They're pretty literate. And when I got there, the theater, I thought, had kind of stagnated artistically. I thought that a lot of the programming was fairly middle brow and a little bourgeois. And bit by bit, I started introducing some more challenging, some more contemporary stuff. And in the beginning, it was a sort of a shakeout time where we would gain one new, younger, adventuresome theater goer, and we'd lose one older person who really didn't want to go there. But then after like 2 years of, 2-3 years of shaking it out, where the theater remained relatively stable, new people coming in, all the people leaving, then we just shot like a rocket. And we had this incredible growth of audience and donation, and it really did become that legitimate mid-sized theater in the Boston area. And we were doing all of the great new literature. We were the theater that was introducing Martin McDonagh's work, Sarah Rule's work.
Wow.
That was sort of the niche that we had carved out, and with a really, really smart audience.
Cool, and you could do that.
Yeah.
What then prompted the exit from New England, and how big was the change coming to San Jose Repertory? First of all, leaving New England for California, but also jumping up to what's I imagine a much bigger institution than New Rep.
The budget here is probably a little more than double what it was at New Rep, and this is a Lord B Theater, and New Rep was still on the small regional equity contract. So one of the things that I realized after about a decade was that I thought that New Rep maybe had grown as far as at least I could take it, that it had found a really happy niche.
Right.
But Huntington and ART were always going to be there. They were always going to be larger. They always had the audience base and the donor base. And I was... You know, I think you have to continue to move forward or you're going to stagnate. Mm-hmm. And I realized that there were artists that I wanted to work with who, you know, weren't going to work at a New Rep salary, right, either as directors or designers or actors. Right. And also, I'll tell you honestly, after about 10 or 11 years, and we had seen, you know, staff turnover, people come, people go, and there were some younger staff starting to come in, which was great. And... They'd come to a staff meeting and say, "We got this great idea about what we can try to do in fundraising, or great idea we can do in marketing." And and I'd be at the meeting and go, "Well, yeah, you know, we tried that in '98 and it didn't work, and here's why." And I, you know, after a while, I heard myself and I thought, "Boy, you're starting to sound like the old fuddy-duddy in the room," you know.
You're right. There comes a kind of, it's like, again, like being a parent.
Yeah.
There comes that moment where, oh, I've got to let the kids now do it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I thought maybe it was time for somebody else to whatever New Rep was going to be in its next incarnation, that it was probably going to be somebody else who would do that. And it was time for me to step out and challenge myself again and run a theater with a bigger national reputation and a larger audience and a larger budget and also to be able to compensate artists, the artists I want to work with, be able to compensate them in a way that I thought was really fair.
Hello, I'm William Mattson, manager of the Terrace Theater at the John F. Kennedy Center for the Performing Arts in Washington, D.C., and you're listening to the Reduced Shakespeare Company podcast.
Where can you RSC the RSC? For the next 5 weeks until July 24th, 2011, we'll be in Washington, D.C. at the Kennedy Center, performing completely Hollywood abridged and the complete world of sports abridged. As always, the very best way to stay up to date about all of our worldwide performance dates is to sign up for the Reduced Reader, our email newsletter. Go to ReduceShakespeare.com and click on the link to subscribe and check out our touring page for specific box office, venue, and ticket information. And now back to my conversation with San Jose Repertory Theater's Artistic Director, Rick Lombardo.
I think this is a similarity here at San Jose Rep to New Rep, is that you, again, followed a beloved artistic director who had been here quite a long time. I don't know whether she was the founder or not, Timothy Neer. She was here when I was in high school.
Well, you know, Timmy might as well have been the founder. The founder of San Jose Rep was Jim Reber, but Jim was involved with the theater for, you know, a few years.
Yeah.
We just celebrated our 30th anniversary. Yeah. Timmy was here for 22 or 23 of those years.
Wow.
You know, I've been here three.
Yes.
So that's a significant body of work.
Yeah.
And the building that we're sitting in, you know, she was the one, along with her managing director partner, who led the charge to have the city erect this beautiful theater that we're in.
So, and she had the exquisite taste to bring us here for the very first time.
Oh, there you go. So that's always a challenge.
Yeah.
And
how do you meet that challenge?
Well, I think that you have to... You know, I've always felt that you can't make sudden breaks for an audience. That what you have to do is you need to, you know, spend some time just establishing your bona fides. You know, mm-hmm. that mm-hmm. what are you like as a director? What are you like in picking plays? What are you like as a, you know, the, sort of the master of ceremonies for the theater? People have to get to know you and trust you.
Yeah.
And then when they trust you as an artistic leader, then you can start to take them in new directions. And that's sort of where we are right now. I spent, you know, a year or 2 years getting the community to know me, probably speaking at every Rotary luncheon that I could do.
Right.
You know, I spent a year doing probably 90% of the curtain speeches, just meeting people and talking to them and hearing about their their love of the rep and what they liked and what they didn't like. And now I feel like I have a really good rapport with this audience, and now I'm starting to take the programming in probably a more adventuresome direction than I didn't want to do right out of the box.
Yeah.
But we're having great response right now. Our subscriptions are up, and that might be the first time in a decade for the rep that's happening. And our donations are up, and. You know, I did inherit a theater that had gone through some really significant financial challenges.
Yeah.
So we've also had to be really smart mm-hmm. about how we spend money and what mm-hmm. we spend it on.
Yeah.
But I think that people have been very, very pleased with, you know, the work you're seeing on the stage right now.
Was there much of a cultural difference coming from New England to California?
Oh, there is.
Can you articulate that cultural difference?
Well, yeah, of course. I mean, first of all... in Boston, every year, the highest-selling play was always in January.
Oh.
Because, you know, by then, you've been stuck in your house, it's freezing outside,
right.
and you're going stir-crazy. So the arts and culture provide a real reason to get out of your house and be with other people, you know?
Right.
In California... there is never that reason.
Yeah, you're right.
You know, I've often said that the easiest thing in California to not do is go to a cultural event or a performance.
Yeah. Let me ask you a more fundamental question. What about theater is great for you? Why did you decide to pursue it, and why being a director?
Well, I'll answer the second part of the question first. Being a director. You know, I would never have thought that I would be a director. You know, I was a son of a immigrant family in New York, and we all had to be doctors or lawyers. That was the path, and my path was that I was going to be a doctor.
Okay.
That's what I went to study in undergrad. And but as a kid, without knowing it, I was constantly just like. Doing all kinds of creative things without knowing that was an outlet that I needed to fulfill. So
right.
I was, you know, I was either getting all the kids in the neighborhood together and shooting a sci-fi movie with my dad's Super 8 movie camera, or I had a dark room in my parents' basement and I was, you know, developing my black and white photos. Or I was playing in rock bands as a musician, or I was acting in high school plays, just sort of flailing around.
But that's cool that your parents didn't go, "What the hell are you doing? Knock it off."
No, they encouraged me.
Yeah.
So then I went to college at Georgetown, and I was okay. Now I'm a serious pre-med student. I'm not doing any of that stuff. And of course, bit by bit, making me go crazy just studying. I get pulled into playing in a band, and then I see an audition for an original musical, and I think, oh, well, all right, I'll go do that. Maybe I'll meet some girls. And so I meet the Undergraduate Drama Society at Georgetown. And, of course, an amazing experience. And somebody asked me if I would come back early for sophomore orientation week, for freshman orientation week in my sophomore year, to direct a play that they always did every year for the freshmen coming in. I guess they asked me because, like, everybody else had said no
right,
at that
right.
point.
Yeah.
Or I was the sucker that would come back early.
I bet he'll do it.
Yeah. So I said, sure, never directed a play. And I came back and I directed a one-act George Bernard Shaw play. And it was like my brain exploded. I mean, literally, you know, if one is lucky enough to have an epiphany, to be able to recognize it, I had one. And I realized that, you know, my love of literature, my love of language, my love of music... my love of making pictures, whether it was a movie camera or a still camera, that as when I was stage directing, I was all of those things were at play, and I was helping other people. You know, I was helping actors do their thing better.
Right.
And we were telling a story, which ultimately is all about telling a story.
Right.
Then sophomore year started the next day, and I went directly to the registrar and changed my major. And called my parents and said, "Hey, guess what, Mom and Dad? I'm not a pre-med student anymore."
Yeah. And?
And they were okay.
Okay.
They were okay. They were like, well, you know, they were amazing. Whatever's going to make you happy was basically the message.
Well, and they must have seen you growing up, and maybe they knew it before you did.
Maybe.
You know?
Maybe. Now that I'm an artist in my early 50s, and I say early 50s, you know, if you said, Rick, if you were to go back right now and do it all over again, what would you do?
Yeah.
I might say that I would go to film school instead of drama school. I might say that.
Yeah.
Because and then if you ask me the question a second time, I would say, no, I had absolutely to go to drama school.
Yeah.
Because honestly, running a theater company right now in this country, in this time, I feel like we are the guards at the gate. You know, we are trying to keep the barbarians on the other side of the wall,
mm-hmm.
because the industry, the art form of theater, is under siege right now. Now, if you were to ask the Elizabethans, they would have said the same thing. So, it is entirely possible that this is an art form that has always been under siege. Right?
Yes.
We are the the great invalid.
Right.
The fabulous invalid, I think, actually. And so maybe it's always supposed to be hard. Maybe theater is always supposed to be dangerous. Maybe theater is always supposed to be a little bit on the fringe. But this is the most, you know, doing this for 30 years now and running theaters for 20 of those years, this is probably the most difficult time that I've ever seen. But the art form still does something. The reason that it still feeds me is that I still think it can do for a community what great church does, you know? People do have to leave their homes. They don't just stick their eyes on a little screen. They can't do it with their headphones on. They've got to sit in the dark next to a stranger. They've got to make a decision to focus and spend time, and they've got to participate.
Yeah.
They can't just passively receive it.
Right.
They've got to be part of the event.
Right.
And the Pollyanna in me believes that, you know, even as all this brilliant technology that I love is coming to, like your podcast that we're doing right now, that the nature of the live performance event is still going to have its value, because it's so deeply coded in our DNA. It's, you know, I often talk about the very first moment of theater was the very first moment of storytelling.
Yeah.
And that was the very first moment when we decided to start societies and civilizations, because without stories, we don't share anything culturally.
Right. Right.
So we are the oldest art form. And maybe that will mean that we will still be there. We'll be the one at the end, too.
Yeah.
When all the lights are turned off.
That's it for this week's Reduced Shakespeare Company podcast. Send us your medium of choice via email to feedback@reducedshakespeare.com. You can also post comments on our website podcast page, and you can post reviews on iTunes. You can interact with other fans on our website and our Reduced Shakespeare Company Facebook fan page. You can also become a subscriber to our YouTube channel or become a twit. Follow us on Twitter @Reduced. You can find easy links to all these social networks at our website, reducedshakespeare.com. Thanks, as always, to Webmaster Matt Rippey, Not a Medium, More of an Extra Large, Matthew Croak, music by John Weber and Garage Band. Our random fan shout-out this week goes to Gretchen Page. No reason, it's just random. Special thanks to Bill Mattson from the Terrace Theater at the Kennedy Center, our home away from home for the next 5 weeks. And thanks very much to you for listening. I'm Austin Titchener, 237/711 of the Reduced Shakespeare Company.
This podcast is a production of the Reduced Shakespeare Company, reducing expectations since 1981. Go to reducedshakespeare.com for performance dates, actor bios, email newsletters, and so much less.
So much less. So much less.